Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
Make your next vacation an experience for the senses. Andaz Hotels and Resorts draw upon the sights, scents, textures, tastes, and sounds of the surrounding culture to offer distinctive, luxurious stays worldwide. Learn more at andaz.com.
I'm Olga Romanov.
Michael Romanov.
He said he was a Romanov.
You know, she's a Romanov.
Checking in for Romanov. I'm a Romanov. I'm so tired of this Romanov shit.
Nicholas Romanov.
I could be a Romanov.
He's a Romanov too.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching the Romanovs. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Blossom.
We're in the home stretch of this miniseries that we're doing on the Amazon series, The Romanovs. This week, we will be discussing episode 6, Panorama, and speaking with episode star, Radha Mitchell. But before we get to our episode discussion and the interview, I wanted to get into some emails and responses that we received in the past few weeks that actually really helped shine a light on something I missed last week and something I definitely would have missed in this episode if it were not for this feedback. So, starting with some commentary in episode 5, Brighton High Circle, we got this tweet from a listener, Scott Bain, whose wife came up with this observation from last week's episode where she told him, no one seems to be picking up on the Rasputin angle in the latest Romanovs. David, the character, the piano teacher played by Andrew Rannells, insinuates himself with the mother, helps the youngest son, and is the target of extensive shady innuendo that the Tsarina decides to ignore. And then there's further connections, like the fact that the father in that story, last week's story, like distrusts David from the beginning and resists him, stuff like that, which is true of the Tsar Nicholas and his feelings about Rasputin and all that sort of stuff. And so, like, I just completely that sailed right over my head. I think it's really quite plainly there once it's pointed out. So I'm comforted by the fact that apparently a lot of people miss that connection. But like, then it made me think about this episode, which is about a sickly son and a mother and all that sort of stuff like that, a little differently. So, I think this week's episode, Panorama, is like maybe another take on that Rasputin, Tsarina, Prince Alexei sort of story. That's interesting. And like, I think we brushed up against this, like, in an earlier episode where you had mentioned something in the history of the real Romanovs that related to the modern day story. But like, probably, if I knew a bit more about the Romanovs, which maybe is some research I should have done more of, I would be able to sort of pluck out these connections a bit easier. But there we go.
Yeah, I had just kind of forgotten the Romanovness of it, frankly, because,
yeah,
you know, I think we got a little bit caught up in the Matt Weiner-ness of it. So,
Well, I think it helps me realize that it's not just this idea of like, okay, someone in the story is Romanov, or this idea of privilege, which we've talked about and we will certainly touch upon again in this episode, but like the idea in which those final days of the Romanovs or the end of the era of the Romanov is playing out, like, you know, in a sort of fragmented way across these modern stories is interesting as well to me. So, you know, that came via tweet. The next two things are emails. If you want to email us, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com, we welcome your emails. This one came from Liz, also about our discussion last week of Brighton High Circle. And Liz says, I love your podcast on this episode. I'm in the minority in one aspect of the interpretation of the show. I don't see Catherine, that's Diane Lane's character, as the audience surrogate or the final arbiter of morality. For instance, she did not do a good job of talking to her kids about the allegations. She jumped to the conclusion that the issue was sexual and passed that notion to her oldest child, child as if it was fact. With her smallest kid, she didn't take no as an answer, pushed too hard, and weirded him out more than necessary. When her husband came home, she let him make the decisions for her, followed his lead completely, obviously relieved to give up responsibility. So when she shut the door at the end, I felt the narrative was not saying that she was making the best possible decision. Maybe it would have been better to keep David in their lives, but keep her cautionary ear open. And in that case, Weiner might have been exploring the situation more subtly by theorizing that while casting someone out because of an unproved allegation is unfair and unwise, turning a deaf ear to the complaint is not wise either. Proceeding with caution may be an alternative to cast out culture for people who have acted inappropriately, but not in a way that rises to Harvey Weinstein or Louis C.K. proportions. Thoughts? Question mark? And then Liz ends saying, I love Richard's take on David's code switching and the unspoken fear of gay men and the sometimes subtle fear of pedophilia. I became more sympathetic to David. So I know you and I had like a, you know, a fairly strong reaction in last week's episode. Mm-hmm. I don't need to like necessarily rehash it beat by beat. But what do you think of Liz's idea that the episode is maybe not coming down on the side of like, yes, never cast someone out? You know, what do you think?
Yeah, no, I think that's a more nuanced read, certainly, than mine initially was. And maybe I should have extended the episode more empathy in that direction. I was so kind of caught up in the gay stuff that I didn't really, I kind of was just like, Matt Weiner's doing this and assumed it sort of unnuanced. And perhaps it was more than I saw initially. So I appreciate that email.
Yeah, I think hoping for the nuanced take is something like we would all want in an episode. Like I think it's good to hope that that's what Matthew Weiner is trying to do with this episode, that he's trying to, you know, show multiple sides of a situation or show a cautionary middle ground. I think it's reasonable given the metatextual aspect of the episode to come down a little harder on a different side, if that makes sense.
Right.
And then the last one is from someone who wishes to remain anonymous. We actually got it a couple weeks ago and I forgot to read it. But this is a person who's like not really fond of our grappling with this subject at all. This person writes, I think your episode where you explained again why you're covering a Weiner series is a bit too much. The longer you talk, the more convinced I became that neither of you had the experience of being in a room with someone who says something that sounds threatening, and suddenly you realize just how far you are from the door and just how much stronger that person is than you are. What comes after that, oh, I was just kidding, ha ha ha, is really immaterial. Anyway, it's all okay. Just admit that you don't know what it was like for her or him. You don't know what the reality of the situation was, and you just discount it all to go for the art. Just don't explain so much. So I wanted to read this because I think it's like worth voicing this opinion. Even though I don't necessarily agree with every way in which we're characterizing this email, I will readily admit that I don't have personal experience with this, which would certainly flavor my response differently. And I definitely don't know what it was like for the woman who accused Matthew Weiner at all. Of course, I don't. I don't know the reality of what happened. That's also true. I don't know, discount it all to go for the art. I think what Richard and I are trying to do, if you're inclined to give us the benefit of the doubt, is to actively grapple with this. This is an unusual thing for us. This is not something we usually encounter when we do a long form analysis of a show. But it's something that I think we are both trying to come to from like both emotional, intellectually honest place. So, Richard, let me know if you have any other reactions.
Yeah. I mean, I appreciate where they're coming from, but I think they also should not assume things about you or me. That's right. All I'll say about that.
Fair enough. Yeah, exactly. All right. So, you know, if you have reactions to this broader conversation or this specific episode, Panorama, and want to email us, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com, we'll happily read out your email. I love hearing back from people. It really helps me better process what I've just seen. So we are going to talk about Panorama, which is an episode set in Mexico City, directed by Matthew Weiner, of course, written by, I believe, exclusively Matthew Weiner this time, starring Juan Pablo Castaneda as a journalist named Abel, Radha Mitchell as Victoria Hayward, Griffin Dunn as the editor, Frank Sheffield, and David Sutcliffe as Victoria's husband, Philip Hayward. And this is, you know, the central story of this is a journalist has gone undercover, a potentially a very bad journalist, has gone undercover to try to expose this medical facility that promises sort of miraculous recovery if you have enough money to pay for it. and he's gone there to expose it because he believes that like this facility is just full of charlatans and making false promises. He meets Victoria and her son, and he becomes sort of like interested in them. He has lied and said he's a patient and that he's sick, and so he winds up lying to them for a while showing them around Mexico City. They're American, he's Mexican, and then in the end sort of confesses to the son and to the mother, one of whom knew, one of whom didn't, and then the father comes down to sort of sort everything out. So if we want to draw our Romanov comparisons, Alexei, the Tsarina's son, was very sickly. This is why, and it was kept a secret. This is why Rasputin was sort of able to insinuate himself into the family to make promises to Alexandra and, about helping, Alexei. And so this idea that she got swept up in this notion of a cure for something that there was not necessarily a cure for, is one connection. And then this other is just the same thing that we've been talking about, where like this journalist is, you know, obviously not very well off, as few of us journalists are. And, you know, a lot of this is class driven, his examination of like, well, if this place can help people, which it can't, he thinks, but if it can, it's only obviously the extremely, like, disgustingly wealthy who can afford it. You know, so what does that even have to say about anything? So, literally the Rasputin, all of that connection did not occur to me until earlier this morning. But Richard, how does that sit with you in terms of helping orient this episode in this larger story?
Well, I think that if you look at it through that lens, and then also in relation to last week, this presents a more, I don't know, not hopeful, I guess is maybe the word, like version of that, a sort of, you know, because I think the crux moment of this episode is the confrontation that Abel has with the doctor. Right. You know, where the doctor, quote unquote, diagnoses him with sort of a lack of, no, I don't want to say faith exactly, but basically he's saying that you tear things down and I'm like trying to make things and then like change things. And, you know, I think if you look at any sort of mystic faith healer, whatever, however you want to kind of allegorize that, from a position of, well, at least they're sort of trying something. Right. I think that the episode then takes on an interesting political dimension. I don't know if this was necessarily, it's probably, the timing doesn't sync up, but, you know, a new president of Mexico was elected this summer. This guy, Andre Manuel Lopez Obrador, who there's a great New Yorker profile of him from this past summer, if you want to read it, where he's this kind of far leftist revolutionary, you know, people are concerned about his kind of his populist stuff and his nationalism. But I think that by the end of the episode with this Diego Rivera mural coming to life and that sense of like forward motion while also looking to the past, I feel like there's some kind of call for political optimism, maybe. I don't know. I saw this as a very political episode.
I mean, it's certainly like very much about Mexican identity and the revolutionary spirit, the nationalism in hopefully the good kind of way. And if this is an episode that's reactionary in a political way, I don't think it's to that Mexican election. I would suspect it's to our own election and like the way in which Mexico has been vilified. I think the timing aligns a bit better with that in terms of like, this is like a repudiation of Trump's, you know, willingness to characterize all of Mexico as, you know, rapists and villains and a threat. And this is like a celebration of the history of Mexico and Mexican identity. And I mean, it's interesting that you have, the Abel character is like pretty much the only, well, other than the doctor, right? Like pretty much the only Mexican character in the story because he's dealing with an American family. His editor is American. And so it's just up to this one figure in the guise of like a tour guide showing this family around Mexico City, to really anchor us in Mexican pride. And, you know, and like, I think what does come through, you know, at times I cock a skeptical eyebrow at the budget of, the Romanovs, but then when I see that, like, you know, this is obviously filmed like on the Zocalo in Mexico City, like that really, I think, comes comes through in a way that feels like, I don't know how I feel about the mural coming to life at the end. I honestly don't know. It's a very big swing and a very like surreal, brave thing to do. I don't know if it landed well with me, but a lot of the earlier stuff really did.
Did it make you want to sing Sunday in the Park with George?
Yeah, bit by bit, let's put the episode together and
finishing the hat. Yeah, I mean, I think the interesting thing about the possible Trump connection, and I think you're right that it's there and the timing certainly syncs up better, though certainly this guy had been running for a while, but in Mexico. Right. And that may be true, but I think if that is kind of the intent, well, but Weiner is also at least gesturing towards some political ailment in Mexico, you know, and all this metaphor of, you know, being sick and getting better and, you know, is it possible to dream, you know, of a better, you know, body, you know, whether that's civic or personal, you know, I don't know how, you know, what the extent of Matt Weiner's knowledge of Mexican politics is, certainly could likely better than mine. But it's interesting to consider that he might be doing a metaphorical gesture toward America, but decides to ground it, you know, to our south. And I don't know. I wonder how successfully, you know. I think, you know, he also gets into issues of race in Mexico between indigenous people and, you know, I guess they would call white Mexicans. And, you know, I don't know. Does it handle it clumsily? I thought it was... I think that the episode was wise to only sort of touch on it.
That's an interesting thing that I think a lot of, well, I don't know. I don't want to speak for anyone, but like, you know, I lived in Mexico for a little while, like very short while in high school. And, I lived with a family where the mom's side of the family was from Spain. And, like, you know, so she was like quite pale. And then the father was, you know, his side was indigenous and he was very, very dark. And like, that was my first introduction to this kind of like skin-based, racism in Mexico. And I didn't know, you know, they like had to explain it to me and I didn't know I was like 16 or whatever. But I think it's not something like, you know, we paint Mexico with this, like, not we, but like those who have no exposure to it in America might just paint it with one brush. And it's like, you know, at least worthwhile to talk about the fact that it has its own internal fractures, because of course it does, because any nation with any kind of identity would, you know, it has its own segregations and racisms and presumptions and all of that. But I think the issue comes when you have someone who's not Mexican, as Matthew Weiner is not. I think if this episode were presented from the point of view of the outsider, it would be more successful for me. But since it, you know, since this Abel character is the narrator of the story, like the episode starts with him, like, you know, almost reciting poetry. It's not poetry. It's quasi poetry. It's his Tinder poetry. You know, it's like you're inside him throughout the whole thing. And Rhoda Mitchell's character is a satellite to his story. And so because it's this inside, let me show you what Mexico City or Mexico really is, then I, you know, feel slightly squeamish when that comes from like a non-Mexican person, if that makes sense.
Right. I mean, I do that. That's all true. But I also think it's an interesting inversion of the kind of like, you know, exoticism travel movie.
The E Pray Love.
Right, sort of. The white heroine or hero shows up in a strange land and, you know, the colorful locals teach them something about love or whatever. You know, like, I think that to ground it in a Mexican story, like, is interesting, whether or not Weiner really successfully does that. Like, I don't know, but, it's, it had a sort of weird shape to it because of that, because I was so used to, you know, I saw that Rhoda Mitchell was in the episode. I saw that we were in Mexico and I was like, oh, okay. So she'll show up and then it'll be her story. And then it certainly wasn't. So, I think it, you know, from a sort of tropey semiotic level, like that was an interesting thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. That's true. I wanted to ask you about, Juan Pablo Castañeda, who I found like a very mesmerizing person to watch. As I like never watched Sense8, and he's done mostly like a lot of modeling and then some things. So I've never seen him in anything is the point. And so I was quite captivated biased performance, but honestly, I genuinely can't tell you if that's just because he's like incredible to look at or if he's like genuinely a very incredible performer. And it's also like not a cheat, but it's also like, it's always a help to an actor when you get their internal monologue, you know? Right. So like that's doing a lot of the heavy lifting for you. But like, you know, the other players in this episode were people that I, you know, recognize. Oh, there's Christopher from Gilmore Girls. Like, sure. But like, this is a person that like, it's such a big thing to put on his shoulders, carry this episode. And it's not, and he's not someone, you know, who is immediately familiar to the audience. And maybe that in and of itself is its, own advantage. But well, what did you think of his performance and his placement in the episode?
I mean, you're right. He looks great. I have to say, I thought he was pretty bad. Okay. I agree that he like held the camera well, and just because he's good looking, but like he has like presence, you know. But yeah. I thought that some of his delivery was a bit flat, you know.
I think his narration is almost more successful than his like line delivery.
Yeah, no, I agree, because I think that like it, he could get into this sort of dreamy tone of it, but then when he had to be conversational, it didn't quite work as well. But you know, I thought it was interesting to cast an actor. Who I think most people in the States are unfamiliar with. I mean, there are a lot of, you know, Mexican actors who, you know, I'm sure would jump at the chance to do a Matt Weiner thing, or do something in such a big budget, that he could have reached out to. So I don't know. I'd be curious to hear, like, what the decision making was behind that. I mean, I think he's certainly interesting. I would watch him in something else, but, I don't know if he quite fit the tone of the, of this piece, when he wasn't monologuing.
And similarly, like, I'm trying to figure out if, like, in what ways or why I had some trouble accessing Radha Mitchell's performance in certain moments, because she's a performer I've always really, really enjoyed. And so I'm trying to, like, maybe it was just, like, the episode itself. The pacing of it felt inaccessible to me. I know you weren't, like, the hugest fan of Diane Lane's performance in last week's episode. That was my experience of this episode. Like, if these are two Tzarinas, like, this was the Tzarina that I was having more trouble getting into. What did you think of Radha Mitchell here?
I mean, I agree that I like her. I think that it's less her fault and more that, like, we've seen a lot of these kind of sad, rich ladies in hotels, you know, and granted, she had something or something's plural to be genuinely sad about. And I don't think that that Mitchell was unconvincing in it, but like, there was nothing really, there was no there. I guess when he said that he was in love with her so soon, I was like, I don't really get why necessarily, but, you know, and I think also that the kind of, speaking of tropes, like having the, you know, guy come and, you know, teach essentially single mother, like how to live, you know, and knows what the kid wants to do more than the scolding mom does. I think that's a little bit tired, you know? Granted, she had a reason to be so concerned about her kid and to be protective and restrictive of his life, but a very good one. But, I don't know. I don't, that sometimes rubs me the wrong way.
Yeah, that's fair. I think that's fair. And then, you know, just to wrap up, our discussion of the episode, like, what did you make overall of, I don't know, maybe like the healthcare angle or this sickness thread through the episode? Like, I know you talked a little bit about how it could be like a political sickness. We talked about sort of spirituality and belief and all that sort of stuff. But what other advantages or disadvantages are there in setting this episode around like a Lourdes sort of environment?
Well, I mean, it's funny. It's not directly related to that, but I was watching that, what I sort of called the pivotal scene between the doctor and Abel. My brain is broken to the extent that like, I'm like, wait, so what's the Matt Weiner in this? Is this like, is Abel the bad journalist critic who like doesn't understand where Matt Weiner's coming from, that he's just trying to like, and yeah, he might make mistakes here and there or think, you know, harm might befall people, but it's all in the name of the greater good, you know, and Abel is the one just trying to tear it down. So I kind of got stuck on that idea for a while. I don't think it's really there. But like, I just tend to think that any time a sort of auteur-y person like this, addresses a journalist in their work, be it in this or in Birdman or, you know, anything else. I'm always a little suspicious of that, perhaps unfairly.
Yeah, I mean, I no, I think that's true. Like, we're trained to have our hackles raised anytime there's a journalist character. And that's why I said, like, maybe a terrible journalist, which is, like, it's something his editor says. And I don't think, I don't know that it's an indictment of, like, journalism as a whole when, like, I think the Griffin Dunn character is supposed to be a good editor, in theory. You know what I mean? And he's just like, but you're just not a good journalist. And that's okay. Like, it doesn't mean all journalism is bad. It means, like, maybe this is not for you. But maybe you should be a Tinder poet instead. But that is interesting. I hadn't thought of that as like a sort of veiled swing at our profession. But I don't think in this regard he's representing all of journalism. But I could be wrong.
Yeah.
All right. Well, is there anything else you want to say about this episode?
It made me really want to go to Mexico City. I've never been. I know it's been kind of, a lot of people have been going there recently. I just, for whatever reason, maybe it's just because the Instagram is so good. I thought it was a nice, I liked the movie. I liked the episodes, you know, sort of more graceful. I like them going, to the archaeological site and looking out. And I liked the ending, corny as it might have been, a little on the nose while also assuming a lot. I think it was effective because I didn't expect it. I like, you know, I think I said this back in the first episode. I like the show getting a little bit magical realism-y, you know, I think it's kind of fun. And then the third episode obviously is much more, but, I appreciate that he was like, yeah, I can do this. I have the budget. I have the location. Let's just go for it.
Yeah, you're right. I think these bigger swings are interesting. And if anyone like is going to try to do it, it's going to be Matthew Weiner. And so it's like, I like it. It's like how I feel about Mother, the Aronofsky film, is like, Mother's not necessarily for me, but I'm really glad it exists. And I'm glad that like Hollywood is not so broken to the point that like an Aronofsky can't say, I'm going to make this like very challenging / alienating film. And like, someone's like, okay, go ahead and try. You know what I mean? And mm-hmm. I wish more artists were given that opportunity, but I'm glad that certain artists, when they reach a certain level, they don't just like sit there comfortably and make like paycheck movies. Like, some of them continue to be like, yeah, I'm going to take this swing. And that, you know, because I'm in a privileged position and I can do so. And that's, I think that's always worth doing.
Yeah.
Always worth taking the swing.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
I'm Claire Fallon.
And I'm Emma Gray. We're culture writers, podcasters, and hosts of the show Love to See It.
Every week, we give an unapologetically feminist dissection of reality dating shows, rom-coms, and other romance narratives. We unpack all the weird messages they send us about love, sex, and dating.
And we dive into all the details with special guests like actors, authors, and cultural critics.
You can find Love to See It wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop every Tuesday.
At Andas Hotels and Resorts, travel means taking in your destination's every sight, smell, taste, touch, and sound. From London to Maui, Napa Valley, Tokyo, and New York City. Andas Hotels and Resorts draw on the unique, authentic senses of locales around the globe to dissolve the barrier between your destination and your luxury hotel experience. Visit andas.com to learn more.
All right, well, let us go to our conversation with Radha Mitchell. Radha Mitchell, thank you so much for joining us. One of the great surprises of your episode is the fact that it's set in Mexico City and has so much to do with Mexican identity. How important did it feel for you to be on location filming this episode?
Well, I mean, it kind of feels like it's a love letter to the city in a way, and a kind of, as you said, an exploration of the identity of the city. And I think it was also, it was very, in a way, political, but very poetic. And I think in order to kind of create that sort of, that headspace, it was great because we started the first day on the pyramids. So we immediately had this sense of history and this sort of mystical kind of feeling that, I don't know, created this contemplative kind of sense of sort of magic. And that was, I guess, the conceit of Matthew. He knew that we should start at the end. And so that's how we began, and I think put us all in the right frame of mind.
That's so interesting because that's such a moment of catharsis for your character. What is it like to move backwards from such, you know, such a pivotal moment?
Well, it's kind of weird to meet the person on, at the end. Like, that's how kind of me and Juan Pablo kind of met there. We met at the Reed, and then we kind of started at the end. But I think we were all pretty clear about the story and what it meant. So to begin at the end was fine. And I think Matthew's very precise also in the way that he kind of directs and conceives of the story. So it was all already in his head. And we kind of were sort of up for the challenge of trying to bring it out into the world. But it was sort of clear what we were doing, very clear to him. And I think by putting us there, it was very clear to us, like, hey, how these people are going to feel, because you just feel that way in the space.
And, you know, you say you feel like it's very clear to you what the story is about. So I would love to hear your interpretation of what, not that I don't understand it. Of course I understand. But, like, what is your interpretation of what this story is about?
Well, I mean, I can understand why you ask, because it is a fairly nuanced episode, and it sort of pivots around having an emotional resonance, and you see these two characters shift in their perspective. So it's a kind of a personal a journey for both of them, and how you see how two human beings can affect each other in just sort of the way that they see each other. I think two people in the story see each other outside of the history, outside of anything else, and outside of their own personal dilemmas. And in being viewed, I think they change each other, or they at least see things differently. Certainly my character sees her situation very differently in the end of the episode than she does in the beginning of the episode when we meet her. And she's kind of, nothing really has changed for her. She's still got this situation where her child is, you know, unfairly going to die. And how does a mother kind of cope with that, knowing that you want to fight against it? So by the end, I think it's not like she's given up fighting, but she's decided, she's had a shift inside of her where she's able to be at peace with the reality of things. And it's interesting to frame that kind of shift in perspective within the perspective of the history of the city, which the story keeps referencing, you know, this kind of class and cultural schism that exists in Mexico City, and how the culture itself is trying to kind of come to peace with the history of things and the reality of how we all are where we are. So it sort of operates on two levels.
Your character has this sort of almost love affair with Juan Pablo's character, but it stops, you know, just short of quite going there. Yeah. And I'm wondering what you think the significance is of it being sort of an almost love story, but not quite a love story.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's something kind of idealized about a platonic love, right? Because it's sort of pure. It's not even a sensorial thing. It's like a soul kind of connection. And also something kind of alluring about the thing that you can't have or that you don't take, that you just imagine. So, yeah, kind of, it's sort of a subliminal love affair. I think, and I found that quite subtle and like interesting and like hard, ambitious to try and capture that, you know, in the amount of time that we had to try and create that feeling, I guess.
Then in your mind, how do you relate your character's journey, which is a personal one of sort of getting beyond these fears, and also the very political, you know, centered on Mexico narrative of this episode? How does all of that relate back to the larger theme of the Romanoffs and the Romanoff story?
Well, I'm not privy to all of the other episodes, but just the kind of conceit of the story. We're looking at a bloodline. We're looking at this kind of privileged bloodline. We all have this idea about what it is to have, you know, the best and know the best and be part of whatever is sort of the top of the pyramid. And then how do you reconcile that with people that are at the bottom of the pyramid? What's just about any of this? And where's the humanity in this kind of crazy story that we're all part of? So I think it's sort of looking at people just being present in the moment without these stories around status and history, and just like in the exchange that they're in, and then it all kind of becomes somewhat irrelevant. That's sort of, I think, what we're looking at in this episode. But in other episodes, I guess, you know, you get to kind of play with Schadenfreude and like, what is it when these, I was going to say a rude word, what is it when these people lose everything that they have? That's cool too. Like, they don't deserve it. It sort of plays with a lot of stuff that's embedded in our psychology about status and where we belong and what we should have and what is equal.
But it's funny, in all these episodes, which have explored these various Romanovs around the world and their various iterations, this theme that keeps cropping back up over and over again is this idea of exceptionalism. It's like, if you have this secret lineage, that means you're more important somehow than people around you. But your character, you know, from the very beginning, she's, you know, deferential to working class people around her and all this, you know, she's very kind. She doesn't presume, privilege. And so I'm wondering why you think your character, your Romanov character, doesn't fall into that trap.
I just think she's somebody who's living for somebody else, maybe not through them, but for them. So there's automatically some kind of sacrifice in that. And so it's not an ego-driven kind of situation, but she does have access to, you know, all kinds of privileges that other people don't have, I guess. But even in this case, we were like trying to figure out, is she a Romanov or is she just thinks she is? I think, you know, she is. Well, I mean, that was sort of like open-ended even in the conversation where we were sort of figuring out who this character is. Yeah, what was the question? Why is she not entitled? Yeah, because I think, yeah, primarily because her sense of purpose is very clear. So whatever she has, she's using to kind of facilitate this goal of, you know, saving somebody's life. That's primarily what her agenda is. And also, I was thinking, you know, she's probably, you know, related to the lineage, but doesn't come with a bunch of cash. I think she kind of married into that in a different kind of a way. So, she kind of had her own kind of journey to be in the position that she's in economically.
One of my favorite things that I've heard about this series is this idea that Matt Weiner not only had like specific rules that he laid out for the series, but he actually had them written down. He told one of our writers at Vanity Fair that some of his rules were like resolving stories, banishing coincidence, avoiding pretension. Are these anything I'm guessing by your laugh, these are things that weren't like directly addressed on set. He wasn't ever like, stop, this is too pretentious, let's avoid it. Like, were these spoken rules?
Well, I'm thinking of it as a lifestyle. it's like a new rule.
Yeah.
I think in this case, he wasn't afraid to like be like, okay, I'm going to like expose myself a little bit here, and I'm going to be a bit whimsical, and I'm going to put in some magic realism, you know, and all of that could be interpreted as pretentious. But to me, it's kind of a little brave, and it is good to like slow down. I like that, and I like things that are not, you know, plot driven necessarily, but are kind of based on the risk of nuance. Like, let's hope this kind of works out, you know. So to me, that's kind of bold, and I'm not worried about being pretentious.
And What is it about Matt's, you know, previous work or his approach to the work that made you want to work on this project?
Well, honestly, I read this. I didn't know who had written it. I just read it and thought, wow, this is really cool. It's so topical in terms of, like, modern medicine and, like, what the future there is. You know, it's certainly in the zeitgeist and what people are curious about. You know, can we live forever as well? It'd be great. And there are, you know, having sort of done a bit of research on this, there are hospitals and there are places you can go, and some of them are in Mexico, and you can get yourself shut up with stem cells and you can hope for the best. So that kind of was fascinating to me. And then I found this kind of intriguing, this whole kind of concept of royalty and the resonance of that. And I do know some people that are from kind of royal families that have been ousted and, you know, no longer royal. That's just so interesting. So that was all fascinating to me. And then to imbue that with this kind of poetic, platonic, romantic, in a way could be conceived of as vague story, was like, wow, a real challenging, unique, original piece. And then when I found out it was Matthew and that it was for television, it seemed to be like a very unique proposition. Yeah. When I read it, I thought it was an independent film. I was like, oh, this is a really cool film. And then they're like, no, it's a television episode. So, yeah, it was just surprising. I think people will enjoy that. It's very cinematic, you know, in this sort of television space. And Matthew, you know, has a reputation for kind of reframing how television can be. And I think he's sort of, you know, adding now to that conversation that, you know, it can be cinematic and it can, each story can have its own identity and it could be different to what we've seen so far.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Great talking to you.
You too. Thanks so much. Bye. That's it for us this week. We will be back next week with episode 7, End of the Line, with the great Catherine Hahn and Mad Men alum J.R. Ferguson, and an interview with Annette Mahendru, who many of you Americans fans will recognize as, like, I think the first actual person of Russian heritage, at least that I talked to for this episode. So things get quite Russian next week on the Romanoffs. Richard, until then, where can people find you?
In Mexico City on Tinder, trying to find that guy. I mean, his settings are probably not set to mine, but, you know, one can dream. And I'll occasionally, you know, get out of Tinder and go check vf.com, make sure my stuff is still running, and check myself on Rylas at Twitter. How about yourself, Joanna?
You can find me on Vanity Fair. You can also find me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. But most of all, you can find me elaborately braiding my hair so I, too, can reenact a Diego Rivera mural in my own living room. Thanks so much. We'll see you next week.
Bye.
The Romanoffs.
I'm Olga Romanoff.
Michael Romanoff.
He said he was a Romanoff?
You know, she's a Romanoff.
Checking in for a Romanoff.
I'm a Romanoff. I'm so tired of this Romanoff shit.
Nicholas Romanoff.
I could be a Romanoff.
He's a Romanoff, too.
Andes Hotels and Resorts blur the line between luxury hotel and locale, immersing you in your destination in every sense, from the dynamic energy of Wall Street to the pristine natural beauty of Costa Rica. Discover more at Andes.com.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Want to stay up to date on the biggest stories in pop culture and entertainment? Then be sure to check out the TMZ podcast. I'm Charlie Cotton from TMZ, the TV show, and every day I'll sit down with a member of our news team to give exclusive breakdowns of the day's most talked about headlines. stories we break and the stories you care about. So check out the TMZ podcast, Monday through Friday, and the other podcasts from the TMZ Audio Network like Last Days and TMZ Verified, available on all podcast platforms.